Today is February 20th, 2015, hard to believe. This is John Rivette interviewing with...
Dean Pajali. UAW Local 724.
And you're positioned here at Local 724?
I'm the president.
Okay. And you just had quite an experience here with some members resigning.
Yeah.
And maybe another time we could talk about that.
Okay.
One of the things that I wanted to do, and we've talked about this several times at Myers.
Yes.
We've run into each other on Sunday afternoons or something.
Other occasions, yes.
I don't know. I want to do a more detailed, in-depth kind of thing with you at some point.
Okay.
And this is kind of the protocol that the university made me do. That's kind of, and it's, this first page is written to other people if I ask somebody to do interviews for me.
Right.
And then it's a set of questions about your name, your birth, you remember your parents' jobs, different things, sort of your background, and then about you at work, and then some things about... certain things about your life, work, leisure, whatever, politics, labor contracts, that kind of thing, and then at the end you sign a release form,
okay,
which allows me to take the stuff to MSU's voice library and also to the Ruther Archives.
Okay. And so you want me to fill that out?
Well, I'm going to 2822467. I'm going to just leave you this so you can take a look and we can think about questions to ask another time.
Okay, sure thing.
I do another one that have you sign. But on this other sheet of paper, this is dated, but I haven't changed much. This is what I call my bucket list of projects I want to do before I die. So I'm trying to do interviews related to the history of the MSU Labor Ed Program. And it's actually something I'd like to talk to you about because we may have met at a class here in this local. I don't know.
You know what? It may be here or one of the other places because I think that was the first time I met you and John Beck was those classes that were offered.
The credit ones?
Not the credit ones.
The uncredit earlier ones.
The ones that you guys had on different topics over the years.
Okay.
When the labor education program was a little bit... more robust, I guess, would be the point.
That's the word the university-type folks would use, robust.
It seemed like there were several different sessions. What I liked about those was it just wasn't from one union. You had a lot of different perspectives.
Right, we had these open enrollment ones for anybody in the town.
Yep, that's what I thought was very impactful because you belong to a union, you seem to have blinders on with that one.
Uh-huh.
I've been blessed to belong to three different unions over the course of my...
I didn't realize that.
Yes, I started out in the paper workers and paper makers, which no longer exists.
So you knew back through that?
Well, we knew that we were in the same local. Okay. We didn't know each other at that time.
Because that's when I met him, when he was education director, whatever, paper workers.
Yeah,
he didn't come from
the UP, and I worked in a small shop about 30 miles from here.
What shop was that?
It was now it's called Georgia Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Back then it was called Olencraft. We made corrugated boxes.
I didn't realize it.
In Owosso, Michigan.
So you did that when you were a young guy?
Yeah. And then after that, I was in the Teamsters.
Okay.
And
the local, Lansing local?
580. Or?
Okay.
That was the first time I held an elected position in a union.
Who was the president or secretary treasurer?
Nellie McKim.
Oh, sure. No, I worked
with her. And I worked at a place called George Worthington Company on the north end of Lansing.
I remember the name, but I don't remember what they did.
Yeah.
It was a hardware
warehouse where they had distribution and warehouse work and stuff like that. I was elected a committee person in there.
Oh, so that was your first union position? What year do you think that was?
I believe that was in 77 or 78.
So how young were you then?
I was 24, 25.
Uh-huh.
So then...
That was a Teamster contract.
Yep, Teamster contract. Okay. And as a matter of fact, what was so ironic, and I was just telling someone this the other day, I didn't have any formalized training
as far as grievance handling
and or contract negotiations.
Uh-huh.
So I did go over to MSU, even though I was not a student. I kind of jumped the turnstile, so to speak, and there were some books that I was able to find that just gave me a thumbnail sketch.
And you mean the library you went over to?
Cool. Yeah, the library.
Very nice.
And so I knew that it existed, having prior to been a student there, but I had never gone to that
section.
Oh,
you went to state?
I went to state.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, on and off for about 5-6 years.
What kind of subjects did you take?
Well, I started out in fisheries and wildlife, and that didn't really...
Because you like to fish?
Yeah, that was it. So that wasn't quite the same thing.
Right.
Then I went to elementary ed, and that was my degree path.
Because you wanted to teach?
Well, that was what I thought I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And then it just family and working got in the way, and I just was
never... You had kids and a wife.
Yeah, never was able to finish that. Going to work or working full-time and trying to go to school part-time was very difficult.
Yeah.
And so... I had to make that decision of, I'm just going to work full time. So the best friends I have to this day are ones I met at Michigan State,
okay.
Not people I went to high school with.
Oh, nice.
You know, so that was...
Other students, you mean?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes.
Cool.
I didn't want to live at home, considering my folk, we were immigrants.
Where from?
My mother's side from Slovakia and Russia, and on my dad's side from Croatia in a small country called San Marino.
Okay.
And so college...
You weren't born there, though.
No. I was born in Sandusky, Ohio, and that's where most of them immigrated to. So college wasn't a big thing. You come over here, sure. You worked. And so when they stressed that, I my intention was not to go to college.
Did you go to high school in Sandusky?
No.
Oh.
By then, we had moved to, Michigan in 1964.
Okay.
And my dad, you know, had got work.
So what year were you born?
54.
54. Okay.
So, you know, I was already... I had my papers to go into service.
Where'd your dad work?
Olin Kraft, Georgia Pacific.
Oh, here.
Yeah, he worked here. Worked
but something else in Sandusky when you were a kid.
Yeah, it was called a different company. He used to... was a carpenter.
Okay.
And then worked at Ford Motor.
In
Sandusky. There's a small Ford Motor. Well,
I know
the
Lorraine plant.
There was a... It was a supplier back when before it became Visteon. It was a Ford plant.
Probably related to the Lorraine Ford plant.
Maybe they supplied...
That was the biggest local that I know in that area.
They were a small plant that I don't even remember if they made headlights or what they made there.
Yeah.
But they did some of that kind of stuff. And my dad said no. Because, like I said, he was a carpenter, but it was cyclical. And then he got into Ford, which was a good job because it hadn't been spun off like it...
Mm-hmm.
Did, and then he got, there was a box manufacturer in Sandusky called Heinendalk, and that's where he got in, and with this...
Related to auto, though? Like,
no, it wasn't
related
complete,
to auto at all.
Not at all.
Okay.
So he ended up being in design, because being a carpenter, he had that analytical piece of mind, so that's kind of how that transpired with him. And so he then got another job, and that's why we... bounced around Ohio and into Michigan, and they moved back to Ohio quite a few years ago.
Folks, so,
yes.
They still are?
Yes, both of them are.
Cool.
And they're both in their mid-80s and living by themselves. You know, they're able to... My dad goes to the Y probably 3-4 times a week.
Good.
And
good.
My mom's starting to lose her vision through macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And she still tries to go to this curves.
Good.
And she...
nice.
If the weather's bad, she's very pious.
They live where?
Between Cincinnati and Dayton. That's where my dad ended up going. We bounced around. We went from Sandusky to Cincinnati to Findlay before we came to Michigan.
Cool.
Yep. So
I'm not too ridiculous a drive for you to go home for holidays.
No. It's just it's about 5-hour drive.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not something you go back and forth in a day.
No, but you can make all the holidays that you want.
Yeah, we try to. But with us having kids and grandkids, my wife and I, we...
How many kids you got?
We have two kids and 11 grandchildren.
11?
And two great-grandchildren, yes.
Two great-grandchildren.
Go forth and multiply.
You're 61 or something?
Yeah.
And you got all those grandkids?
Yeah. So
I only got one step-grandson.
Yeah. It's a challenge during the holidays, paying off the bills.
It's a lot of gifts.
Yeah. Well, we don't, a couple of them have fallen way off the radar, so we're not involved with their lives as much.
Uh-huh.
One granddaughter and a couple other things. So we do what we can with them. And
so, the Lansing job that you worked, that was UAW, which was called what plant?
The first UAW place I worked at was called Ren Plastics.
Okay, what was the second?
And then when I was downsized from there, I ended up at the Carquest Distribution Center.
Yeah. So I remember you. in open enrollment classes. John Beck ended up coordinating the UAW credit thing that we did later, which
that's
we kind of internally called the Danny Hoffman classes.
Exactly.
Because that was the region sponsored us, and they got us to teach credit classes, labor history. I don't remember all the
series.
There
were four components.
Exactly, right.
Yes.
Modern labor concepts.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And Danny was in charge.
Right.
Because that was his job before he went to the AFL and before he came back or something. I've got it in the notes and files, but I'm not memorized. But he came to us from U of M.
Oh, that's
Labor
right.
Labor Center.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those I did. I taught some here at 602. I actually taught more of the Flint ones. We did Flint first before Lansing.
Yep.
And I thought Beck didn't get involved in those until the Lansing ones.
I believe you're right because when it started out.
Credit ones.
Yeah, yes. And when it started out, if my memory serves me, it was very small. And one day John was over here for the enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be over here and we got to talking. And he asked me if I'd be interested in attending. I said, well, I'd be interested, but I don't have tuition assistance.
Because the 602 and 652 and 1753 and I'm missing one.
There may have been 1618 at the time.
Okay, all of the GM UAW had tuition assistance.
Right.
TAMP funds that they could use, and it paid for the education classes.
Where a lot of us in the IPS and the TOP sectors of the UAW, if we did have that contractually, what it was it had to be direct related to your job.
Okay.
So it had to enhance your job. So if I was going in an apprenticeship and I had to take some classes at LCC to become machine repair, they were able to take care of that. But this was above and beyond. So John had mentioned, I think this was after Danny had passed away, John had mentioned that there was some discretionary scholarship money and had asked me if I'd be interested. So we talked quite in length, and so I said, sure. And if I'm not mistaken, they offered a day and an evening session.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very small groups. I mean, we could have them in here and not be overflowed.
Oh.
And that was
the Lansing ones.
The Lansing ones,
yes. The Flint ones were much bigger.
They were.
We had like 60 people sometimes, 30, 60.
Then maybe that was the first two semesters, so I went with some of the same people, but I was the only non-General Motors person.
Okay.
So then...
In fact, at first we did them, Lansing people went to Flint.
Exactly.
Right. And,
yes.
And that's why they were so big. And then later, maybe after Danny either passed away or had gone to the state Fed, maybe John Beck then got involved.
Maybe that's it.
And then they got split in half.
What happened then was...
That would make sense.
Lansing Car Assembly closed in 05. And so all those people that were on layoff in the jobs bank took these classes. So automatically the class... got gigantic.
Okay.
And so some of the same people I started with, I think that may have happened after the first two semesters. Then that happened. I'm trying to remember.
Okay. That would make sense.
A few years ago. So all of a sudden it got gigantic.
You think it was about 06?
04, 05, yeah. Maybe
okay.
About 06, yeah. Because if we had taken the first one in 04 to 05, it may have been there.
Now some of the ones... were at 602 of the credit ones, but other ones were at the golf course. I don't know if you ever took the golf course, but I taught in golf course
we
once.
We did them some. We did.
Do some we do here the, at this hall?
Yeah, I thought we did.
I just remember them at 602.
Yeah, we did do them here too.
Okay, I remember at 602, and I remember this golf course, Hawk Hollow,
up there on Chandler Road.
Yeah, and there was a guy from 652 or something who was the coordinator.
Oh, okay.
And anyways, No, I'm getting them mixed up. That's Pell.
Oh.
That was paid education leave that we did there.
Yeah,
and that was 4.5 days. And that was just the GM UAW folks.
Right.
And those were the Hawk Hollow. And and I would teach either all of Monday and half of Tuesday or something in part of them.
Yeah.
And John had a piece of it, and Michelle maybe some. And
I think Michelle was here, and there was another woman who used to be a nurse.
Oh, Kathy Lundy.
That's it.
She did some of those.
Yep, she did one section, and then... There were different instructors, I think, for each section.
Usually, you did one three-hour set. It was a six-hour day, and one instructor would do three, but sometimes scheduling or whatever, I did as many as a couple days of it.
Yeah.
But usually you just tried to have you do one half of a day.
There was
Julie Brockman might have done it, or
maybe there was a guy who filled in for John when he went to South Africa called Neil.
Oh.
Was it Neil?
Well, Neil Vandervoort had been there before, but I don't think I think Neil had retired by the time we got to the. Oh, Neil Layton. Neil Layton.
Was it?
Yeah, he's.
Is he from Flint?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
He was U of M Flint political science professor.
Yeah.
Who retired to Hazlitt.
Yes, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine going back to the 1980.
Well, because when John started the class off, then he had that sabbatical or whatever, the trip to South Africa.
Yeah.
Then he came in
and did the history session.
That piece of it, and then John made it back at the tail end of that particular quadrant. So that was interesting because it opened their eyes to non-GM UAW.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that any time I had an opportunity to, when they would say, well, this is how it works, I'd humbly raise my hand and say, where you work, it does. In our world, it does not. And they couldn't believe that we didn't have subpay, that if John worked at plant A and they laid people off, and plant B was a part of this local over there and needed people, they didn't have to take you, even if it was from the same company.
So this is the second thing we'll pursue in follow-up interviews. So another one of my interests is this area about the part suppliers and UAW, IPS, and the Allied Industrial Workers.
Yes.
UAW 182 originally, and then AIW 182.
Right. UAW and, AFL.
And lots of people have written a lot on UAW CIO and lots on final assembly. Not much is done on parts supply. So that was an area that if you could give me a hand and give me some names later of people. And in fact, you know Sandy Zirkle.
Yes.
So Sandy's helping me out, and she's going to help coordinate getting names and addresses and phone number, and she's getting a schedule of people that I might interview over the next couple of years.
Okay.
So,
because it's interesting that when the IPS sector started many years ago, what it was they actually took raw materials and made things. Whether they ended up in the auto assembly plants or not, they may have. But they actually took stuff like the drop forges. Like there's two hammers right there. That they actually took that stuff and were pure manufacturing. The IPS sector of today has changed just a little bit. There are still some of those, but what it is their light assembly. They take components from ABC, wherever, they put stuff together, and then they ship it to LGR, LDT. I'm just talking about Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not as much manufacturing as they are assembly.
Gotcha.
Where those particular processes that they're doing now used to be done in these plants.
Mm-hmm.
But then when General Motors kind of pushed those out, I'm going to say probably the late 90s, somewhere in through there, where they took sequencing of parts, the trucking back and forth between some of the places, seating, some of those operations, then eventually migrated to these other companies who had to buy into the GM just in time. You keep your costs low, and we can replace you whenever we want to, kind of a theory. You know, it's the thing we always say in this local is, well, if GM catches a cold, we get pneumonia because of the impact it has. And we do have considerable amount of our people laid off right now, in the grand scheme of things, with this second shift at the Grand River plant.
Okay.
There has been some impact there. And because, John, the other thing that bothers me is how these companies have gone into, for lack of a better word, disposable employees by contracting with these temp agencies. The obligation is not for full-time permanent. So when they lost a piece of their core business, the people that they had to then jettison were not their seniority company employees. They belong to an employment agency. So it's hard for, the numbers are skewed with how many people we actually lost. So example, company ABC has 450 UAW bargaining unit members, where they very well could have 550 people working within the confines of that could be considered doing bargaining unit work. Mm-hmm. But we can't claim onto that other 100 people. So we are, if you were to look at it in a utopian way, our membership could be well over 2,000. But in reality, it's probably closer to 1,800, give or take a couple. And so that makes it, and two, our locals had to evolve like anyone. We're just not purely the IPS sector. We do have two TOP units here, too, as well.
Now, for the sake of taping, TOP means?
Technical, office, and professional. Mm-hmm. It's like GM, Ford, Chrysler, AgAmp, Aerospace. Mm-hmm. That's another sector right there.
I've come up with seven topics that I want to talk to you about in the future. And okay. I'm going to have you Xerox that.
Certainly.
Another one of my big subjects is labor and politics.
Okay.
Another is labor department, the Michigan Department of Labor.
Okay.
I don't think much of these would be relate to, but those four, I think, written out in this other way. So if we do it again, and I hope we can schedule one that maybe April, we'll do it in a second.
It
doesn't have to be immediate, but whatever you want. Want to talk to you about other family or work stories, and you can look at some of these kind of things. Family, work, leisure, you mentioned about hunting, stuff like that. A little bit about more about you. Then you as a worker and as a union officer, mm-hmm. from committee to being president, to the extent, you know, if you don't want tapes and stuff, we'll just press pause.
Sure.
Because it might be something that you don't want. Not that I think, you know, McEntee's going to go try to find the tape right away, but, you know, maybe, whatever. I've done this long enough, and so, you know, I interview people, and somebody, I interviewed Frank Kelly.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and about just politics, not his life. Many people have interviewed him about his whole life.
Yeah,
but we got along just great, like you and I, because I knew people that he knew back in the 50s and 60s, maybe. I didn't know him personally, but I know enough history that I knew what he was talking about.
Sure.
And he'd forget that we were taping it. No, you can't have that on tape.
Because he knows where the bodies are buried, huh?
Other people, so I was interviewing another person just a couple days ago, and just several times we just pushed pause because he wanted to tell me stuff as kind of a friend or acquaintance, whatever.
Yeah.
But he didn't want it on the tape, and so, you know, I do that all the time. But what it means to be either committee or what it means to be president and some of the kinds of stuff, I mean, it's a fascinating thing, and they're scholars, they're people who study this and write articles, papers, and it'd be interesting. So one of my questions, kind of as a researcher, is to what extent is the UAW-IPS and the AIW similar or different in how they represent part supplies? And so, you know, you and I've interviewed some people. So another whole area is community services, labor and politics, relations with 182, and then drop forges. And then labor education. One of the people you knew well, who I interviewed many sessions, was Walter Campbell.
Sure.
And we talked about him in terms of community service, which is what he's so famous in Michigan labor.
Absolutely.
Michigan community services.
Absolutely.
Labor. But we also talked about him as a worker, him as a union officer.
Yeah.
He was big in AIW.
I don't know.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And a big supporter of labor education. And then he also worked in the Department of government area, because he helped do the work comp or unemployment comp was Walter.
Yep.
So I don't remember, but we might have paused it a few times so it wasn't on tape, because he was going to tell me something about Bill Marshall did this or something.
And he was, the old MESC is who he was involved with, the Michigan Employment Security Commission back in those days. Walter, the last few years of his life, Glenn Freeman and myself and our predecessors took him to the Dobie Road Nursing Home, Ingham County Nursing Home. And his wife was there for quite a few years. And when it got to the point where he could not drive, Glenn and myself would take him over there once a week.
Close to him.
And he was a character.
He was a wonderful man. Great stories that went way back. And the last time I interviewed him was at his apartment on Pennsylvania.
Yes.
But his wife had already gone to the home.
Yes.
And it was It was interesting.
Yeah.
We were talking about old AIWs in that setting.
Yeah, he was...
he went way back.
He was quite a...
He went way
he
back.
He was quite a knowledgeable, and I didn't... The first time I met him was up at the UAW Education Center.
Mm-hmm.
Nolan Owen brought him up there.
We should also talk about Nolan.
And he came up for our community service school, and he usually come up a couple days. And I don't know how he knew it.
How Walter or Nolan?
How Walter knew me.
Oh.
Maybe Nolan told him. I don't know. I was the community service chair of the local at the time.
At 724?
724. And so he asked me about the Melling-Dropford strike and what was going on up at the strike. So he was well-versed. So whenever I would pick him up, he would ask me, okay, what's going on in town with labor? He wanted to keep the pulse on that because he had different groups of people that he would depend on for different pieces of information.
So that's another thing we should talk about, the Melling-Dropford strike and other big events.
Yeah, and so I thought that was very... And all these people were coming up like he was a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to stick around so I could fill him in, and we spent considerable amount of time talking about that kind of stuff.
Just
so
decent,
yeah, it was my wife and I would, because his family was out of the state, so my wife and I made sure on his birthdays, if he didn't already have other things, we either went out to eat or brought him over to the house. I'd go pick him up, and I remember one time, because he grew up on Lake Michigan, I grew up on Lake Erie, so yellow perch mm-hmm. were.
Was,
so I said, well, I told him, Walt, I'd gotten some perch. I think I went fishing with one of my uncles. And I said, you want to come over to the house? He said, sure. And so I get him, come over to the house. He's sitting down at the table. And I start to prepare him. He says, oh, you can't fry mine because he had congestive heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way I know how to do them. With perch, you gotta batter them and you gotta deep fry them. At least in my book, it's probably not the best for my health. But anyway, so he said you gotta broil them, and I went, what? He said, don't worry, I get to eat perch. And I just remembered that, and I'm going, this is really hard for me to do. And he got a kick out of that. And once in a while, him and I go grocery shopping, and I. Uh-huh. He liked ring bologna, but because of the salt content, he had to be careful. So he didn't get it very often. And what, he was having trouble going up that little flight of steps to his apartment and back down.
Yeah.
When we would come over, we'd knock on the window.
I went to his house a couple
of
times.
Yeah, knock on the window, and he'd come up. So one time I had a key made. Me and Glenn had keys
made. Oh, very nice.
So he didn't have to worry about that.
Well, you know, you and I and Glenn all collected some stuff of his, and I don't know what we ever did with it. Did we?
Glenn got some of it.
But what did we do with it?
Gosh, I don't know.
Because we talked about we were going to do something.
Yeah.
And maybe this will spark us again, because some of that could go to
right.
It could go to MSU,
you
if
know,
he has some MSU connection, or we could send it to the Ruther Archives in Detroit if he didn't.
His family got a couple things, but then they sent a couple things back.
But you are... And I, or you, Glenn and I
think it might have been Glenn.
Looked at stuff. I got a couple things, but there was a lot of stuff that came from the state federal offices.
Maybe it's still there in the basement where they have that storage area.
I know exactly where you mean. Selden Wright and I spent a lot of hours down there.
Yeah, yeah.
And we better. Some of that stuff needs to go to the Ruther Archives or MSU Archives.
I'll talk to Glenn.
MSU Archives will take stuff if it relates to MSU in some ways.
Yeah.
But Ruther Archives will take stuff, and they have a new director down there. Guy came from the UP,
uh-huh.
Eric Nordberg, and he helped run the archives out at Michigan Tech University. He did a lot of stuff related to unions and miners and stuff up there. And now he's in charge of the Walter Ruther Archives. Have you ever been there?
No, I have never been there.
You and I can go down there.
Okay.
No, what we're going to go do is we're going to look at the IPS files.
Okay.
Because that would be very, very useful.
Sure.
And we also, we'll get Zirkel to help out. We'll figure out who it was that was in charge of that in some of these years. The IPS had a unit, and they had a, you know, leadership and all that.
Yeah, yeah,
and I'm sure the mostly guys. Top would be mostly ladies, but IPS was probably mostly guys. The
Carolyn
guys.
Forrest, I think, at one time, yeah. Vice President had that, and Cindy Estrada did, but you're right.
Well,
you're right.
But the people that would have been out of this region who
did
it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
But tops would have been usually women because it was the UAW clerical unit.
Yep. And a few other ones, but you're right. But traditionally, it's been like that.
But we had, when we were doing, like you said, robust labor studies out of U of M, Wayne State, and MSU especially, you wouldn't know I worked for U of M before I started studying.
Yeah, I remember you saying that one time, you know.
Well, I also went to school there, which people in this neighborhood would rack me over the coals for.
Yeah.
I would get. I remember one labor leader, not in this town, but one other town. Every time at the start of a class or if I'd go to a labor council meeting to pitch the class, he would sit there and he would say, how the hell can Michigan State University hire a graduate from the University of Michigan? And he would just work me over.
Oh, my gosh.
And then people like Brayman would work me over for being an egghead or something. And it was great fun.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
This local was very important to me. And I think, in fact, you were in one of my steward training or steward committee person in the 724 hall.
Very well could
and
have been.
Before community service.
Oh, yes.
And you were this CarQuest
distribution center.
And you might have been a new committee person for him or something.
I think so because we... When I had gone through a couple years where I didn't work steady, and finally got back to work at this distribution center, and it was non-union, and I could tell immediately because I was making half of what I was making previously.
Any guess what the pay was then?
I started at $4.25 an hour.
What year you think?
1981, and when I left the shop, I was making like $8.59 an hour,
okay,
with work uniforms. You know,
when it was union.
Yeah, union.
Yeah, yeah.
So
twice the pay.
Yep. And there was a their sister facility in Bay City was unionized, and for the most part, they passed down the wages and benefits. But one thing they had negotiated back in those days was a two-tier. So I started out $2 less than everybody.
Oh.
And you were supposed
as a new hire.
As a new hire, yes, sir. So it was a growing of 2 years. But they had the ability to bump you up. And, you know, I mean, what did I have to lose? I had a family to feed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got up to that two, but I still was $2 less. So eventually I got up to that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but I remember you being in classes here.
Right.
And you were kind of the different guy because you were from a smaller workplace.
Right, we only had like three dozen people.
And when I first got involved to it was long, long ago, there was a guy, Joe Svensky, was the president.
Absolutely.
And at that time, UAW 652 and 602 basically used the Lansing Community College for their labor studies, and a guy named Marty Bakken ran these credit programs because
okay,
UAW was pressing, let's have credit labor studies. And MSU didn't want to play
okay
in the credit labor studies. We were doing the non-credit. But I had Lansing as my region. I was the central region.
Okay.
I went from Clare down to the border,
not
very wide. So
yeah.
I had places like Ionia and Mount Pleasant, Alma. But in those days, we ran regular class. We'd have two or three classes just in Ionia in a year.
Really?
They maybe do two or three classes a year now, the whole thing. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
But as there was some cutbacks and layoffs or whatever, not layoffs, just not replacing people, I ended up picking up Flint, too. So I had Lansing and Flint, and then the little ones weren't so much anymore.
Right.
But Lansing and Flint was a lot.
Yeah. There was a little bit of density there, wasn't there?
I was busy.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
At first, we had a whole person just for Flint and Lansing plus these small towns.
Right.
But it was fascinating because you wouldn't think of Ionia as having much, but they were their own labor council.
Yes.
And they're at least two classes a year we'd run there.
Wow.
At this little local hall downtown, third floor.
I think they've since
Furniture Workers Hall.
Yes.
Yeah, now
yes.
they're part of the...
Kent Labor
yeah,
Council.
Yeah, the, yeah, the Grand Rapids Labor
yeah.
Council.
What was it? There was that bumper company that was union, I think, at one
yes.
time, and there was a couple
well,
other
and there
small
was the,
shops.
And there was, but there was the corrections officers.
Yes, that's true, too.
Right.
Even though it was a statewide union, they still had some folks.
They had
that's
local.
Right, that's
yeah.
right, yeah.
Because I used to do that. I did years of doing MCO stuff from the
gotcha.
Beginning when they first got a right to
okay.
unionize.
Okay, okay.
And so that's something else I'll talk to you about later.
Sure.
I'm a retiree,
yes.
and the MSU program doesn't seem to be much interested in doing stuff, so I'm making myself available to do classes.
Okay.
I mean, I'll charge something for it. But,
sure.
But, because there have been some labor people who said, you know, we'd like some classes. Is there anything there? And I'm saying, I don't, you go find out if you can.
Yeah. It's been so long since we've, there used to be mailings that would come out at least quarterly.
Yeah.
Because there used to be that one-day seminar they had with labor law,
mm-hmm.
and they'd bring in people from all over the
yeah,
place.
Exactly, statewide.
And then you guys always had a wrap-up
uh-huh.
after the elections.
That was
the impact of the elections,
yeah.
and I can remember going to that a couple times.
Yeah, I did that after every
you know,
even year.
And it seemed like there was a
we had a few things.
Workers' comp, just workers'
yep.
comp
yep.
session.
Ed Welch, the former director
Ed Welch,
of the
that's
state.
Right.
Worker Comp Bureau did classes.
And there would be quite a few different ones that were staged across there.
You probably came too late. We had health and safety quite a bit in the 80s.
I think I did take
Scott
one.
Scott Tobey was in charge.
I think I did take one health and safety one.
Okay.
But it may have been after that because we didn't organize that facility until 89.
Well, we
so would have
been
why
doing
was
them
there?
Maybe
I,
not as vigorous. We
yeah.
Had.
Yeah, I was. We had tried organizing before, and it failed.
At which place?
At the Carquest Distribution Center.
How long did you work there non-union?
That's a good question.
That's
okay. 8 years.
Doesn't matter. For just
8 years.
Okay.
And then my last dozen before I went on union leave were with UAW. And then...
when did you go? Union leaves, meaning you're full-time union staff person paid to...
Well, I'm at the United Way.
Oh, okay.
My full-time permanent
when
position.
When did you become that?
2001. I replaced Dave McClellan when he retired.
Okay.
So communities that have a large labor population and a large United Way drive, organized labor population, put staff people on that are
mm-hmm.
Union members but are employees of the their respective United Way. And we've had liaisons at the United Way, Community Chest, whatever that's morphed over the years since 1954. The
and
first two was Oscar Wade out of the UAW and a guy from the painters called Tom Borst.
So I didn't know Tom, but I interviewed Oscar
yes,
Wade.
Yes.
Long ago, I
yes,
interviewed Oscar
yes,
Wade.
Yes, he's a character.
Unfortunately, I don't know why Nolan and I never got.
Yes.
There were a number of people that. I would, and this is what I told you just in the last couple months. There would be people that I would sit and the person would say, sure, John, let's set up an interview.
Yeah.
And we'd get busy, and then the next year, well, we should set up
yeah.
this interview.
I
don't know how many times Garrison and I were going to do an interview
yeah.
and never got it.
And I talked to Dave, talked to Jim Cassane, and it never transpired. I says,
yeah.
John Rivette would like to, and I've even sent letters out to the guys too.
Well, you've been very helpful.
And you know, yeah. I feel bad that we couldn't talk to them now that they have since passed away because
but.
I learned a lot from both those two individuals, for example.
Yeah.
Different pathways,
yeah, yeah.
community service, and to watch Jim Cassane work a table on an arbitration or a grievance or something like that. I would have been throwing things where he was just like that. And my first servicing rep was Lloyd Kane.
I remember him a little bit, but he was more 02 or 52. And
he was out of 02, but he represented a lot of the suppliers.
Right, but we did, like I'm saying, in the earlier days in Lansing,
yeah.
I didn't get, even though
right.
they were huge. I mean, the 652 might have had 10,000 pamphlets.
Oh, yeah.
It was insanely huge.
If not a few more, yes, you're absolutely right.
But we didn't get people,
yeah.
except for a big statewide conference,
yeah.
because
yeah.
they did themselves, because they had a big education department.
They had joint programs and everything else.
Right, or they did it through the community colleges where
yeah.
they got credit.
Yeah.
But 724 was my main place, and we had these open enrollment classes. So in a class of 25 people, there might be five UAW, four of which were 724, but the others were Teamsters and rubber workers, communication work.
Yeah.
I mean, rubber wouldn't be right, but,
but still,
each town there would be.
There'd be a unique skill set to that particular town, and that's how I got to know some people that were from this local that I didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And then we also did regional grievance handling classes that I got to know other people from other UAW locals. So it was.
And you probably also went to UAW sponsored ones like at Black Lake as you got going into it.
Yeah, I, you know what? Because, not that I knew everything, John, but we had committee people that had no training whatsoever, had never been in a union before.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was better that when we did have the funds to send them versus myself.
Sure.
So I've never gone up to the regional fall school setting. I've always gone up to the community service.
Okay.
The UAW used to have just a big community service session. They don't do that anymore.
No, I went. In fact, the first time I did the Michigan labor hit, the from Calumet to Kalamazoo story of Michigan unions, one of the first times I gave that to a labor audience was at Chaney Creek.
Oh, okay.
And Walt Campbell was in the room, and there must have been 200 union members there.
Because I did do one session where, for lack of a better word, was a facilitator slash instructor.
Mm-hmm.
They had a linkage package that was part of their EAP program.
Right.
And they had community service people, and there was an EAP person and myself. And I enjoyed that because it was a unique interaction between not just the big three, but also sometimes their management counterparts, which I had never gotten into that. So sometimes I was talking only union, and I could see some of their fumes rolling out of their eyeballs, I should say. So
I started in 77, and I had Lansing's part of my region, and it was the only one big enough to have a real advisory. We used to have a statewide advisory committee, and then we had regional ones.
Oh.
And Lansing was my only one big enough that it was had a real committee.
Yeah.
And Nolan Owen and Dave McClellan were the two key guys.
Yeah.
So not only would we have three times a year a meeting of everybody, the three of us, Nolan, Dave, and I, would go meet at one of these bar and grills and talk over what do you think really people need in this town and what class might go and is there something different you could do. And I created a little survey which we'd give to people in a class where they would be asked what class do you want to see. And so I would tell those guys what it was, and then Dave or Nolan would say, well, why don't we push at the meeting for this one or that one. And they were creative guys.
They were.
And
real good guys.
Nolan and I came up with something, we ran it at least once at Kellogg Center probably, on sort of community service, but it was about abuse, about substance abuse or something.
Oh, really?
Really early.
Yeah.
Like,
because it was just one of those things.
Or mental health, maybe.
Don't worry.
It might have been mental health.
You know what? His daughter was mentally challenged.
That's why. And she came to the thing.
Yeah.
I met her, and I met his wife. And
Yeah, he's a good guy. Fact is, he always loved to tell the story that his first union was 724 before he got into the board.
Yeah.
I don't remember what plan he worked out of, but he started here.
He told me. I don't have a tape that says
I don't either.
Nolan.
I don't either.
I kept some files as a pack rant. And part of what I'm doing is I'm turning all these interviews over to this voice library.
Right.
And then documents that I have, if they're useful, they'll take there, and ones that aren't there, we'll send it to the Ruther Archives.
Okay.
Because they take UAW stuff. But anyways, I really think you and I should schedule to go to sometime to the Ruther Archives.
Sure.
We'll have somebody meet us and show us some of the IPS files, and
you might
be able to help me out.
That would be nice.
But so, a lot of stuff. Another.
Do you want me to make a copy of that, you said?
Yeah, when we're done, but I'll have you sign something. Drop forges. I wanted to talk just a little more about drop forges. When I started in 77, and I had Lansing as part of my region, and I did stuff for 724. I don't know how many units there were, but I'm going to say there were eight, a dozen, something, and almost all were drop forges.
For the most part, they were. We had Atlas, we had Lansing and Federal, Melling and Lindell. So there were
Five.
That I can remember, there were five drop forges.
Is Lindell the one that was on Lyons Avenue?
No, that's Olufsen.
But that
they
was,
were not a drop forge.
No, but they were one of yours also. They were one of your non-drop forges.
Right, and then you had IMCO, Industrial Metal Products.
They weren't a drop forge, but they were both.
They organized in 72.
But they would both be parts suppliers.
They were
auto-related, weren't they?
They did some auto-related. They would make specialty machinery and also did small parts.
Okay.
So, but they didn't necessarily, that stuff didn't go to the automotive.
Mm-hmm.
It may have gone where they were turning cranks at a Chrysler plant.
But in terms of how the UAW would represent them, I bet it, they did it through the IPS.
Absolutely,
unit. They wouldn't have done it through GM or Ford.
And then we had Ren Plastics was another one back in those days.
Your biggest non-manufacturing was, and the gal's name was Rhonda Kane.
Delta Dental.
Delta
Dental.
But
they didn't organize until 1979.
Yeah, but I'm talking about my beginning of 77. So,
So
they were your biggest non-union clerical type group.
Right.
Real,
and I think
much more ladies. There weren't.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I think the reason, and I've never heard it, but when I started kind of digging through some of that,
mm-hmm.
was I think the reason why that they were placed in this local is that there was not an amalgamated local at that point in time
mm-hmm.
for right. them to go into when they organized. Because 2256, the one that has the city,
right.
county,
mm-hmm.
Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and stuff like that, Accident Fund, was not around because,
right.
Like, Accident Fund was a state agency.
Yeah, exactly.
City of Lansing was an independent union.
Right, right.
Because I worked for the City of Lansing when it was an independent union. And,
you did?
Yeah, in between getting laid off from the shop and then, yeah,
wow.
one of them short stints before I then got hired.
You did everything.
Well, back when they had the two-man garbage trucks, I was the guy hanging on the back.
Very fun.
One of the very hardest jobs I've ever had.
Independent Lansing.
Yeah, it was a Lansing, Lansing Employees Independent Union or something like that.
In Grand Rapids, they stayed independent.
They still do.
Much later.
Yes.
And I went over and did some classes
yes.
for that independent because they
yes.
didn't have any international to
yeah.
do anything for
yeah,
them.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like CTU.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though CTU's
yeah.
kind of been, you know, talking with the Labor Council,
yeah.
but they still want to remain there.
Well, they don't think the membership would buy it, I
yeah,
guess.
I think that's what it is. And so, but
yeah, Grand Rapids stayed longer.
Yeah.
I forgot that Lansing was in there.
Yeah.
And anyway,
so
you were much more drop force, not entirely.
No,
but
you're right. And if you look at the people who were the presidents and financial secretaries.
Like for McClellan.
For the most part, came out of one of those drop forges.
Svensky, I mean.
Yep. Yep, yeah. And Joe is the longest-serving president of the local.
Yeah, he was a real character when I met
was,
him.
He was up to the day that he passed away from the few times. I can remember one time.
Was he like Catholic Polish or something?
Yeah.
Old school.
Old school. One
yeah.
time. One time back in 92, we had lost a considerable amount of members. And
yeah, you guys got small before you got big again.
Absolutely. I think we bottomed out like about 99 when I became president. We were down about 600-700 members.
Okay.
So there was a bylaws change because at that time, the bylaws had hardwired into them full-time permanent status, contractual almost, for the financial secretary.
Uh-huh.
The whole thing. So what happened was because we had lost so many people and Dave McClellan had just got appointed to the position at the Capital Area United Way,
mm.
that was an opportunity for some people to say, we need to right size. We can't continue to keep operating
right.
the way we did. So there was a big meeting. We'll talk about the bylaws change. And I was still kind of somewhat green around the gills, but I mean, I'd been involved enough to know what was going on and stuff. Mm-hmm. I was the unit chair. So we go out there. And back in those days, everybody could still smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So the place was just full of it, you know?
Oh, classes in the first years were so awful.
And then
you'd have them
smoke eaters on there and didn't do a thing. And so, of course, there was a lot of Drop Forge guys in there. So they were always talking loud. And if they couldn't hear, you could tell which ones because they were turning their ears. So here I am sitting, Joe Savinsky on one side and this guy named John Janchewski, who worked at Melling, on the other side. And so they don't have any inside voices. So Joe's going to me. He says, why are they doing that? Why are they doing that? I said, Joe, we're down to about 600-700 members. How'd that happen? I said, all these places closed, you know. So he had moved up north after he retired. So he wasn't quite you know, in the loop as much as he was. He knew what was going on, but not as much. And so then Yanchuski, I tell you, John, his fingers are about that big around.
I don't know if I remember him. But
he was our retiree chair for a while. He operated a crane there at Mellie. Okay. His hands were just gigantic, just stout, you know, like that. And so he says, "What's that mean? What's that mean?" Poking me in the arm. So back and forth between these two guys, I'm going, how the heck did this happen to me? So we get done with the discussion and everything else. I get up the next morning, go to work. I go on my arm. I had a black and blue mark from this Yanchuski poking me off. And then I had this ringing from Savitsky talking, you know, real loud, kind of trying to whisper, but he couldn't. But it was interesting in those days because that's who dominated, even though a lot of them had closed out. Because I'm trying to think, my one brother-in-law worked at the Atlas, and I think that was 85, 86.
They were one of the first to close, I think.
I think you're right. Then, Lindell was a little bit longer than that. Melling, obviously, after the strike, and then what morphed into Bratfords, the old Federal, Lansing, whichever way you want to look at it, that was in 2012. Okay. And so, but they were down to just so small of what
I
they
had
was.
Switched to, so in 04, I didn't lose my connection to the labor school, but I no longer work for them. I don't know if you ever had that explained, but I went to work for the central administration.
Right. I remember you saying that.
Resolving grievances, because the faculty are non-union, but there's elaborate
stuff. There's a process, and you were involved in that.
Well, I was in charge of it for 8 years. And they unfortunately didn't replace me. And so they just kind of dropped off some of your classes. Nobody was picking them up very much from 04 on. And it made me upset because they got money from the central administration to replace me, but they used it for other things.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it was kind of very disappointing. Back to the guy with Svensky on one side and the other guy on the other side.
Yanchuski.
He sounds like another Eastern European name.
Yeah, they were both Polish.
So Lansing Forge history, I don't know if anybody's written much about it.
Oh, geez, I did it wrong.
Doesn't matter. Just print the other one. It doesn't matter. They just need to, for the record, they didn't care. Anyways, I know more about the Detroit Forge ethnicity stuff than I know about Lansing. And it may be the same or it might be different in terms of ethnic groups, racial groups. Do you have a sense at all of what Lansing was like that way?
It was a mixture of Eastern Europeans, people who came up from the South. When the migration came up from there, Tennessee, whatnot, that didn't get into the...
Meaning African-Americans or hillbilly whites?
White. And then there was also some African-Americans. And later on, some Hispanics.
Okay.
I've got a picture in there that was taken at a Lansing or a Federal Drop Forge picnic. And I'm going to say probably at least one out of every three people were African-American.
And what year do you think that is?
I think it was in the 40s or 50s.
Okay.
So that, to me, said that there was a different kind of thing. And you go to any foundry, and it's kind of, look at the big foundries in Saginaw.
All black,
you know,
workers.
Or Hispanic, or a combination of both. So it was a, and then also, later on, there was a lot of people who came from the surrounding areas.
Farm kind of communities?
Yeah, so they would come from, you know, your Owosso, Perry, maybe rural Ingham, Ionia.
I found that very fascinating. So when the UAW at GM started shrinking and the international started shrinking education staff and stuff, and more of the people started taking our classes, the GM here in Flint, because we didn't have Ford or Chrysler right here.
Right.
I did some Ford stuff in other communities, but not here. It was fascinating, sort of the workforces and people and stuff like that. And one of the things that struck me fairly early was a lot of people like Gary Watson from 652 next door as the president, and then the president of the whole thing. We should talk about labor cap council at
cap
some
council?
Point, too.
Okay.
It was fascinating how many of the guys in charge were sort of semi-farmers or had another business on the side.
Had a lot of different things going on. Yeah,
but a lot of them. And I guess I noticed it also because I got active in the Ingham County Dem Party.
Oh, okay.
And there would be some leadership people, like in modern times, a McAtee, or just till very recently, Art Loon or something. But the more local guys weren't UAW sort of GM types in the Ingham County Dems because they didn't live in Ingham County.
Yeah.
I mean, the staff rep might come, a McAtee or somebody,
right.
The person who's in charge of the camp council or something might come. But the activist local guys, the UAW that we did have were African Americans living across the train tracks here in the West Side Lansing neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there were a lot of those, like Cyril McGuire,
right.
who I got to know pretty well,
and
Charlie Bennett. Not all were UAW, but a lot of African American labor leaders for Lansing. But the Ingham County UAW guys, the big, the GM types, they weren't Ingham counties. They were much more farm based.
Right,
they
were outside that realm, and so we can, since there's been, back to the CAP Council, there's been one woman who's been the CAP Council president, Mary Ettinger from Local 6000.
Oh, and I got to know her because she was state government.
Yep.
She was a nice lady, but she probably lived outside the city.
Yeah, she did.
Because I don't remember her in the county.
You're right, there was all walks of life and stuff like that, so it pretty much stayed with that for a long time.
And it was fun.
Yep.
So this has been great. We've talked for 55 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And lots of other things to talk about, but
let me make a copy of that for you before I forget.
Thanks, Dean.
That. Sure thing.
So John Rivette just interviewed Dean Pajali on February 20th, 2015 at UAW 724. Dean is the president of the Amalgamated Local UAW 724 that used to represent drop forges. Today has a different mix, and we can talk about that mix in a subsequent interview, along with other things that we talked about.